Okay, well, last time I described simple supergravity in four dimensions, and in this lecture I want to say a few words about four-dimensional supergravity models and then pass on to the 11-dimensional model. So just a brief couple of comments about simple supergravity. Is it equals 4? It admits one simple modification, which is geometrically quite interesting and also considerable significance recently in relation to the ADS-CFT correspondence. It admits a cosmological term. I'll explain what this means. And it's a negative cosmological term. In other words, if we take the Ricci scalar or scalar curvature in the Einstein-Hilbert action, we change it by just adding on a constant or subtracting a constant, the Euler-Lagrange equation will be of that form. In other words, instead of having Ricci flat background, it's an Einstein space. This constant lambda is called the cosmological constant, and this is called the cosmological term. And in supergravity, it turns out that lambda can be introduced, still maintaining the supersymmetry as long as it's negative. The conventions I'm using are such that in positive signature, positive lambda would correspond to a round sphere. In fact, you can introduce a length scale, which I think may enter later lectures, by that formula in four dimensions. And then the supersymmetry transformations get modified so if this is what we wrote down last time, which effectively is just the Levi-Civita connection acting on it, plus a fermionic term, if you want to include it. You get this piece here. In fact, this is part of the pattern. It's quite convenient to define an operator, differential operator, by that formula, putting a hat on. And of course, what we mean by hat now, well, let's suppose we're linearizing around a classical background. It doesn't matter, actually the formula remains valid in this case, but you can think of that as Levi-Civita acting on spinners, and then you introduce a 1 over 2 L mu. So you've modified the ordinary Levi-Civita connection, excuse me, by a piece here, which, if you like, is an endomorphism valued one form, take its values in fact in the spin or the Clifford algebra. And if you uniformly make this replacement in the spin 3 halves action, or the Verita Schwinger action, then you get the theory with a cosmological constant. Well, what about killing spinners? So here I'm making contact. I hope the thing fits geometers on there. We want to, now in flat space, the most largest supply of killing spinners would come when we took the flat metric and then we just had constant spinners, and that corresponds to what's called the maximally supersymmetric ground state of the theory. But it's clear that a constant spinner doesn't satisfy this, the equation del hat mu epsilon equals zero. Because we can take a commutator, if solutions of this exist, then, well, flat's got to equal zero. But if we're just in flat space, the contribution of this, which comes from commuting Levi-Civita, which is the Riemann tensor, will vanish, but there will be a non-vanishing contribution from this term, which is, of course, just proportional to gamma mu, gamma nu. Well, that gives the obvious clue that you can suppose the background satisfies this equation. It's constant curvature, in other words. So if this is true, which is constant curvature, then del hat nu vanishes, the commutator, and that is the integrability condition effectively for the solution of this equation. You may verify that a space satisfying this, well, what would a space satisfying this be? It would be anti-de Sitter space. So the claim is, on what is called in the physics literature ADS4, which you can think of, the homogeneous space, metric space, just a quadric. In flat space with the two times E32 quadric g of x equals let's see, minus 1, g is diagonal, plus minus, and x is in E32. So this space time, which has many interesting properties, it admits full complement of Killing spinner. It's obviously a solution of the equations of motion, and so it is the maximal SUSY ground state. For the theory. Well, you can go on and develop the ADS side of things. It also exists generalized PP waves. Well, they would have half SUSY. It would be the analog of what I wrote down last time, etc., etc. Now, the main point, however, is that you see that in general, the Killing spinner equation is going to have something here. It's not just going to be Levi-Civita. And so, in supergravity, we have to go beyond the situation mentioned yesterday by Morrison, where we're looking at constant spinners. That's a special case of the holonomy problems that we'd like to solve. But the more general problem is you've got some endomorphism here, which we'll see more examples later. And it's a very interesting question to classify and discuss the geometry of all spaces admitting constant sections with respect to this derivative operator. And it's a problem which I think has not yet been solved in full generality, but it's geometrically extremely rich. Just to illustrate that and stay in four dimensions momentarily, let me just say a few words about n equals 2 supergravity. N
D equals 4.
Well, this is a theory in which the basic multiplet is the graviton. What's called a photon, it's not quite a photon, and two gravitini. Well, this is a multiplet of n equals 2 supersymmetry. And it's clear that if we pursue what we were doing before, you'd write down a Lagrangian for the Einstein term. You'd write down two Lagrangians, if you like, for the ratio Schwinger field. If you wanted to get started, the full Lagrangian we write down in more detail. So in fact, you could just put an index on the ratio Schwinger field and let I equal 1 and 2. And there's basically an SO2 symmetry going around here. And the object, so we think of R2 equipped with its standard symplectic structure, and that's usually written like that, just an alternating tensor. And so we want to put here, well, to lowest order, we clearly put the Maxwell field. So that's just F is d mu a nu minus c nu a mu, as usual, or F is dA. And then, actually, there are some coupling terms. So all of this is, in fact, in the full theory. And then there's a strange coupling term, which I'm going to write down. Caution, this is not the Einstein tensor. It's a two-form, which I'll define shortly. J nu, and then times epsilon ij. Okay, so this is a bilinear form in the fermions, whose coefficient is determined by a two-form G nu. Gamma 5 is a volume form in the Clifford algebra. Well, this is Hodge dual with respect to the Lorentz metric. And G mu nu is F mu nu plus, Jesus, F hat mu nu. There exists the definition of F hat mu nu. Here it comes. And hat mu nu is d mu a nu minus d mu a mu. And then there's some term phi bar I mu by j mu silent I j. For some reason I've put minus mu interchange nu. But probably that's not necessary, actually. That's probably double counting, because I think this is already skew on its indices. Anyhow, for safety's sake, that's what F hat is. Now, this theory is invariant under supersymmetry transformations, of which the interesting thing is the hatted operator. Okay, so I write down the supersymmetry transformation. Well, there's some here. A mu transforms like this. and Delta Psi Mu is D Mu of Omega acting on Epsilon I plus a term of this character F hat Mu Nu Gamma Nu plus F hat star Gamma 5 Mu Nu Gamma Nu on Epsilon. So, considerably more complicated in structure. Now, it has a couple of properties, one of which is that it's got a rigid O2 invariant, and it's actually also got electromagnetic duality invariant. F and F star come symmetrically in this model. You can rotate one into the other. And it's an ungauged model. None of the gravitini are minimally coupled. Minimal couplings do not come into the action here. The couplings are all via this funny hatted derivative. Well, the omega is the omega that would get you'd get by solving the field equation in the for omega. In other words, it's got a fermionic piece in it.
So it's what you call omega
half. Exactly. Yes. It's Lebesgue eta plus a torsion contribution coming from the gravitinos, not from the photon. No. Okay, I'll make a couple of small comments about this model. One of which is, you can ask what are the supersymmetric vacua of this model, and that means again looking for killing spinners, and the killing spinner equation will evolve now. Let's see, where did I write it down? Here. Let me write down that killing spinner equation, which is the key point. Written down before. Okay, anyhow. Del hat mu is del mu on epsilon I, say, plus 1 over root 2, sorry, 1 over 2 root 2 epsilon I j. Well, let's do it around a background and forget the distinction between the fermionic contribution. This equation is slightly more easy to solve if you combine the two Majorana spinners into a Dirac spinner, the complex structure, of course, being given by the epsilon to complexify by the underlying real vector space. So anyhow, what we're interested in are solutions again of this equation, and we can ask for the maximal number. And there's a surprise now. Of course, flat space with trivial connection has a full complement. But there's another solution, which is ADS2 times S2 with an appropriate monopole on the S2, or an electric charge on here, or any dual rotation. I think things like this will be discussed in greater detail by Gary Horowitz. But this is maximally supersymmetric. So you see the vacuum here breaks rotational symmetry, which is a little bit surprising, breaks the rotational symmetry. You normally think of it's a homogeneous space, but its isotropy group is not maximal. And this is a prototype, it's easy to verify this by simple computation, of a phenomenon throughout supergravity. It's sometimes called spontaneous compactification, although there's nothing very spontaneous about it, but what's happening here is that there exist these ground states, as we call them, which are compactified in a natural way, and moreover contain killing. This is a metric product, this particular example. Now one can go on to play some games and ask about solutions for which you have half the total amount of supersymmetry. And that leads naturally to a certain class of black hole solutions. And one observation, these black hole solutions have the following property, that there's a time-like killing field which is got from the killing spinner, but it can't change from being time-like to being space-like. So this translates into black hole theory, as will be, I think, described by Gary Horowitz, as telling us that it's always an extreme black hole and near the horizon. It looks very much like a metric product, so you have a kind of spatial interpolation. Well, I won't say much more about that. I will say another remark about this theory, which is that the O2 symmetry can be gauged. In other words, making it local. What this means is that the couplings to the fermions are minimal, if you like. In other words, you replace the derivative by acting on the fields mu. Excuse me. By del hat mu, sorry, del mu psi I plus some number, let's say, times epsilon ij a mu psi j. In other words, you can now think of this as a SO2 or U1 connection, where this is the charge. Now, if you do that and go through the supersymmetry exercise, what you discover is that you must have a cosmological term. This was almost the death knell for these theories when this fact was discovered, because the magnitude of this cosmological term is quite disastrous. I thought I had written on a sheet of paper what its magnitude is. Yes, that's right. You get a formula of that general character, which, if this is of magnitude, it should be for the physics, fine structure constant or something. And this is Newton's constant. This is such a gigantic value as to be completely ludicrous. So this really killed off gauging of supergravity theories, except amongst certain dedicated fanatics for many, many years. Now, the pattern repeats itself with greater complexity as one goes up the line from n equals 1 n equals... Well, it's a non-renormalizable theory, of course. Now, what you can do is work out the beta functions, if that's what you're asking. And these beta functions are vanishing above n equals 4, and below n equals 4, I think you're probably right. They have the wrong sign.
But strictly speaking, if you were thinking of this as an infection theory, wouldn't you learn some of the neural features, correct?
No, no, it's minimal. I say once you've gauged the SO2, it's you have beta functions. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This relationship remains true for all of these gauge theories. N equals 1, N equals 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 is the same as 8, and they go up to a maximum of 8, getting in complexity. But in all of these theories, you may acquire extra scalar fields, but the ground states typically have a negative cosmological constant of this sort. Okay? Now, rather than write down an exhausting list of all of these theories, they can be obtained, in principle, from the big daddy of virtually all supergravity theories, which is the D equals 11, N equals 1 theory. So I'd like now to pass to a consideration of that theory. The simplest way of getting the ungauged theories from an 11-dimensional theory is obviously to consider that the 11-dimensional space is just the product of 4-dimensional space curved by, topologically at least, by some torus, and then do a Kaluza-Klein reduction. So that's how one can get these theories. If you want the gauge theories, then you have to take a more complicated setup to come to later. So I wanted to make a few remarks about this 11-dimensional model, and it is unfortunately not a very simple model, so it is difficult to represent it in a simple way. But I'll come to that later. Okay, so this is the maximum you can have. I mean, if you go through the representation theory described by Freed, you find that if you were either in 4 dimensions and wanted more supersymmetries, or in fact in 11 dimensions and wanted more supersymmetries, your multiplets would contain particles with higher than spin 2. So they would contain new fields whose interactions we don't understand, and it is widely believed that there is no consistent theory of higher spin fields, higher than 2, if you have a finite number of them. So I think one cannot say that that statement has been proved to the limit there. I mean, it's rather an experimental subject, trying to get things to couple and then finding some inconsistencies. Okay, so that's why we stop at 11, and that's why we stop at N equals 1, because of the degree of freedom counting. If you do the degree of freedom counting, well, either from the multiplets or whatever, the gravitino is easily seen to have 128 degrees of freedom, which is these helicity states. That number is made up as follows. We are interested in the transverse polarizations in E9, so we use a 16-component spinner, and we've got a spinner vector, so 16 times 9, but then we've got to take off the gamma trace, so that's 16, should be 8 times 16, should be 128. Now the graviton, as I described last time, as was described earlier, is a symmetric trace-free tensor, and that accounts for 44 degrees of freedom, so that's a half of 9 times 10. So that should also be 44, minus 1, excuse me. Taking off the trace, so that's this sim to 0 of Freed's lectures. So we need an extra field. And if you do the counting, what we need is precisely what we want, which is 84 degrees of freedom. And so the idea is try a four form. And I'll explain briefly in a moment how that works as far as degrees of freedom is concerned. So for counting purposes at least, a fourth form satisfying suitable gauge principle will work. So what that actually means is, at linear level, that we add an extra bosonic field, so a fourth form
I'm going to call it F,
although it's popularly known as G current circles. And linearized theory says that dA is F, and we also impose delta F is 0, so that's obviously equivalent. Locally, it's dF equals 0. And so it's just a form of generalization of Maxwell's equations, and the Lagrangian that you would write down for this, which can instantly be put in a curved background, is just minus 1 over 48F squared. How many degrees of freedom does this field have using the counting procedures based on the light cone? Well, you've got to give A the field, the three form on E9, and that should be worth 9 times 8 times 7 divided by 1 times 2 times 3 equals 84 degrees of freedom. So we seem to be in business. We have as many bosons as fermions, and the first step is to write down the first approximation to the Lagrangian, which I shall write on the blackboard. So we obviously have minus a half r minus 1 over 2 psi bar mu gamma mu nu rho del nu psi rho minus 1 over 48 f mu nu squared. This is a root minus g. Who likes a root minus lambda rho? Okay, so what can we do now? Well, what was done historically is to essentially apply the Noether procedure. Now, this was done by Cameron Julian Shirk, well, finished off by Cameron Julian, and you start with the supersymmetry variations, which you would anticipate from this and this term. You've got to think of a rule for transforming this, and that will modify the supersymmetry transformations. So you patiently go through the whole thing order by order. You would usually introduce some coupling constant and organize it as a perturbation theory. One of the interesting features, I'll write the full term thing down, is that actually this leads, amongst other things, to a Chern-Simons type term for F. You see, in 11 dimensions, there's no reason why we should stop at this, and in fact, there is an A wedge F term that comes out of this theory with a very specific coefficient. Which is dictated by supersymmetry. It's a very rigid theory, at least perturbatively, and I was in terms of this expansion. For example, there's no cosmological term allowed. I don't believe it can be well, there's no symmetries to gauge. It's a theory without very many symmetries. Interesting, actually, that it has sort of unusual parity properties because of this. And I just want to make one small remark, which others have made as well, of course. There's actually a choice in this theory. You see, used to be advertised as the theory with no choices. In other words, once you'd bought the 11-dimensional package, you were led uniquely to this. But there is an interesting choice, which may or may not be significant, which has to do with the parity and the sign. See, we have this, we're making use of the fact that the Clifford algebra, the way I think about it at least, here is R of 32. Now, actually, there are two Clifford algebras in this dimension, and they differ because the gamma 11, the product of the gamma matrices commutes, it's central, and gamma 0 up to gamma 10, and its square is 1, and therefore it can take two values, and those label the representations, and that's a convention about parity. So, in fact, there's a twofold choice that's made here. An interesting question is whether or not that twofold choice is somehow resolved in some overriding structure, but that seems to be about the only choice that you make when you set out the classical theory. Now, what does it actually look like in detail? I'm not going to write anything on the board. I've copied out some overheads to give you an indication of what the theory looks like. I copied them from the original references, and so the conventions are different, and in any event, I think if you actually want to do calculations in this subject, you have to choose your own conventions and figure out all the I's and whatever. I chose my convention so as never to write down and turn that one off, unnecessary I. But in the original papers, they use gamma matrices, where they use the opposite signature. The gamma is a pure imaginary, there's a few I's that come into the Lagrangian. So what I've written up here is the Lagrangian, so it's copied from the original papers. And you see what we have here. Now, I should have defined everything on this overhead. I hope I have. You see, it's actually a rather inexplicable mess. I have no insight whatsoever into this theory. I'll talk a bit more about how one may gain insight, but it's a sort of inexplicable mess. You see, because the connections you use at different bits of the Lagrangian are different. There's a sort of elision between omega, omega hat, and all manner of other stuff. This is this predetermined term for the Chern-Simons with these kind of conventions. You see, there's a quarter there, I've been using a half and so forth. But it's fixed. You can't monkey around with that. And then the couplings, F is just this four form. This is actually this derivative, and then you see here is this omega zero is the spin connection that you calculate from the frames, the Levi-Civita. Then you add some contorsion, I think this is called, and then you work it out. It's given by this expression. And then yet again, there's omega hat, which has got this piece in. And it's a slightly different omega hat usage from what I've used. There's an F hat again as a fermionic contribution to the four form. And the supersymmetry transformations, which close on shell, are of this general nature. And key point is that the four form comes in with this combination into the covariant derivatives. Now, you see, when we do a reduction, that four form can turn into three forms or four forms or two forms. And there's a very tight correlation between this and the work on calibrations and special holonomies. I don't know what the tight calibration is, but the thing is very rigid. In other words, there's no flexibility in choosing this operator. There's not a great deal of flexibility in choosing your calibrating forms. And in many special cases, we know that that killing spinners correspond to the constant spinners related to calibrations. And so there is clearly behind this an interesting classification problem, which is from this Lagrangian, throw out everything except the bosonic fields and look for all supersymmetric backgrounds. That's a well-defined problem. We know lots of them. amongst that garden of objects are all Kalabi yards. Well, yeah, there'll be some Kalabi yard spaces and other things. So it's a kind of framework which supersumes a lot of geometry. Now, the supersymmetry transformations close on shell, which is the content of this overhead. Again, I'm just going to flash it past you without asking you to look at it. Oops, too carefully. So if I've got two, actually looking at it, I realize I don't absolutely understand everything, but you see the point, if I've got two supersymmetry transformations, I define this vector field, and also I define this scalar quantity here, and this rotational parameter, and this gauge parameter. So this is allowing me to gauge the A field. In other words, A is the gauge freedom to add to A the exterior derivative of the two form. And if you then compute these brackets here, what you find is that you get, well, you see here you get the lead derivative on E, which is what you'd expect. Then you get this little extra fermionic shift, and then you get, which is a super transformation, a rotation of the frame. And again, you get similar things happening here and happening here. This is the fermionic equations of motion, or proportional to it. So the whole thing closes on shell, in other words, subject to the Euler-Lagrange equations, and gives what in the physics literature is called a soft gauge algebra because of the coefficients not being constants. So that suggests some diffeomorphism structure, which I'm going to come to shortly. Okay, that's the end of that. Let's raise the board. Thank you. So I want to finish lectures by making some remarks about how to view this theory in a computationally effective way or a handleable way, and then relate it and discuss two basic important properties of the theory, which are central to all of our present understanding of what's called M-theory, which are that it naturally has within it a two-brain or membrane, and it naturally has within it a five-brain. And one can view that at two levels in terms of an action for a so-called fundamental two-brain, or an action for a five-brain moving in a supergravity background, or one can view it at the level of classical solutions of the equations, which themselves behave like solitonic or extended objects which have the character of a two-brain or a five-brain. Now, before I describe that, I just want to say a few words about superspace. Which is a very formal procedure, but I think the moral here is as follows. People who've actually done serious work in the subject, like, for example, write down the M5-brain action or the two-brain action, which is written down by Bergsoff, Seskin, and Townsend, all use the superspace approach, which was pioneered shortly after the construction of the theory by Kremer and Ferrara and by Brink and Howe. And I think it's pretty clear that if you want to get to the bottom of what's going on here, you have to master the superspace approach, and it's a relatively simple one. And I'm going to outline it. I'm no expert on this, but as far as I can see, playing around with those equations I showed you is a mug's game. It's a remarkable achievement that they could be written out. But okay, so I'll briefly indicate how this goes. Now, any superspace is really this space on which that supergroup acts. So it's the sum of, in this case, 11-dimensional Minkowski space plus a copy of the spin representative, the spinners. And it's conventional in the subject, which is why, of course, many people are put off, to use some index notation here. And a typical index notation is to replace mu and alpha by a collective index m. This is going to anti-commute, and this, of course, commutants. Okay, so mu, so n corresponds to the index pair mu and alpha, and this runs from 1, or 0 up to 10, tradition, and this 1 up to 32. Now, in the formalism, and I guess if you had wished you could call these abstract indices, anyhow, there's a sort of convention that's used. Letters like M correspond to so-called world indices. In other words, there's a coordinate basis, DZM, a supercoordinate basis. So that would be 50 dx, d theta. And then indices A are thought of as tangent space indices. In other words, they're labels. They label a basis. And so the idea is that you introduce a frame, EA, which if you wanted to write it out, would be written out in terms of a matrix of coefficients. And these guys are general functions of x and theta. So this is a frame field. And in physics, each component here is called a superfield because it's a collection of fields and it has a theta expansion. Practice, this goes up a long way because there are 32 of these guys. So it's a big Clifford algebra. So you're brushing a lot under the rug. Some of the zeroth components at theta equals zero of this frame field will be E A mu, in other words, will be the Fierbein, and some other components, the fermionic ones, will be Rauter-Schwinger. So those are at order zero, and there's a whole bunch of other coefficients which we're not going to write down, which are to some extent slightly redundant because we can perform super diffeomorphisms of this space to get rid of many of them. I'm using here the conventions of the paper of Brink and Howe, which is extremely attractive. I mean, admirably brief and to the point, although they don't give details of all computations. So now I introduce a set of spin 10-1 valued one forms, super one forms, which in that paper we write down like this. Now, to say that they're spin valued, means that as the indices, big A and big B, if you like, run over the tangent space, in other words, as they run over either bosonic or fermionic, there will be a piece in here which is the ordinary spin connection when both of these are bosonic, or could be thought of as an ordinary SO spin 10 connection, spin 10-1 connection, and there will be the when both of these are fermionic, then that's just the image of that. Well, put it the other way, if these are two fermionic, then I have a spin connection, or something in the spin group, and if these are both bosonic, then I have its image under the standard homomorphism, and otherwise I get zero. So all those cross terms are zero. So we have some Lie algebra valued differential forms, and we can define in the standard way the torsion TA. Yeah, sorry, that's what I said. Yeah, that's what I said. I start with the spinner. Okay, and then I take its image under the usual homomorphism to get the...
So there's only one
superfield? Yeah. Yeah, there's a single superfield in that language, yes. That's correct. Yeah. Now I compute torsions, T, formally. They compute torsions and curvatures. So these are with respect to a suitable graded notion of differential of exterior derivative, which I won't go through. These should be subject. These are subject to Bianchi identities. If I call, just to give it a name, it has to be D E A, then they can be concisely written as. Where that's the curvature 2 forms. Now we haven't got enough structure on this space to proceed. So what we do is we introduce a three form. So we introduce a three form A, which of course can be written as, I guess, MNO DZM DZN DZO, etc. And then we have the four form F. Well, imagine we introduced a three form to begin with. Then we have the four form F, which is DA in the supercategory, and the Bianchi for that is DH is equal to 0. Sorry, DF is equal to 0. Actually, in the original papers it's called F, so that's why. Okay, so now what we do, we put a box around that equation, and we put a box around these equations. Sorry, where did I wrap them up? Okay. And now we grind through. We impose these as constraints. So now impose these. And solve for the independent component. Everything's expressible in terms of a superfield. So the claim is all expressible in terms of superfield, which is the component F A B C D, the Lorentz indices of x and theta. No, I think not. Here, just Bianchi's. They're sold in this way. That's the statement in the paper. The solution is, gives you torsion constraints.
But you haven't written down anything you need that ties F and the frame.
Okay, so let me think about that. Yeah, that's what they claim is an output, as far as I understand their paper. That's my understanding of the statement in the paper.
But excuse me, I'm a bit confused, because I thought this, the act identity you wrote on the left side, first depends on the definition of U and R. So, a little bit hard for me to understand how you get additional information out of these equations.
Well, let me tell you what they say in their paper. I don't claim to be an expert on this, and as you can see, you found my weak point. But the claim is, I understand it, that imposing these constraints...
Well, my question was that... So
yeah, I understand what you're saying.
For arbitrary choices E, omega, and A...
Right.
So how could you get an extra information?
Well, what they use in their paper, let me just say. What they claim is that they solve these coupled equations, which they claim gives the on-shell equations, when expressed in terms of these, of the supergravity theory that I've just written down. Anyhow, what they've certainly claimed to have exhibited is a solution of these. Maybe you need extra information, but that's what I read their paper to say, but I'm now confused by your question.
So your notation is little b squared equals 0?
No, I don't think it is.
So then df equals 0 is not a conclusion from what you have. I mean, it is a condition.
Now, the claim, that's the claim made in their paper. So let me now briefly talk about the membrane. Okay, I'm happy to come back to this point. So later... So then, both halves, so membranes. Berghoff, Sinskin, and Townsend constructed an action precisely using these superspace formulation. And then, again, I'm not going to write an enormous amount down, but what they consider is an embedding from some three-manifold, let's say three, into the superspace. I haven't given it a name, so let's call it Z. It has coordinates Z. So, in other words, they gave embedding maps, which are superspace valued functions of the coordinate xi on M3. And then they wrote down the action, which is the sum of two terms, essentially. So the first part is essentially the pullback of some Lorentz metric on the tangent space, minus some cosmological term. So this is the obvious membrane action. This is essentially the... and then they had another term, which is can be thought of essentially as the pullback of the three form A star over the manifold M3. So this is the pullback of A from superspace. And the point of their paper was to show that this action exhibited what's called Kappa symmetry if these constraints were satisfied. I'm sorry, A is a three form on superspace. Oh, eta is a metric in the tangent space of superspace, frame metric. Okay. Okay, so now later, in fact very late as it turns out, a similar technique was used by Howe, Sinskin, and West, where they constructed a five-brain action. But again, they used superembeddings, but they superembedded a superspace, in fact, in this case, some six-dimensional superspace, 16 fermionic coordinates mapped into this 11-dimensional superspace with 32 fermionic coordinates. And the corresponding construction agrees with one worked out in components by other authors. Here you get the equations of motion, that's right, sorry. Yes.
In the five-brain
case, that's right. I beg your pardon, I shouldn't say the five-brain action, you're right, it's the five-brain equations of motion, my apologies. Yeah, here you get the action, here you get the equations of motion, my apologies.
So what action in the membrane case, what's the property of the action?
It has this Kappa symmetry, which is a fermionic gauge invariant, so as to get a supersymmetric action, the analog of Kappa symmetry for the superstring. Okay, well, I make those as observations. Now, the key point is that the construction depends heavily on the superspace formulation. Now I wanted to close the lectures briefly by going back to the classical theory and perhaps anticipating some of the things that Gary Horovitz will be saying in more detail in his lectures. So I have a few more minutes. So, we can first ask for maximal through the vacua. And, of course, the trivial flat space is one case, but there are two other cases of interest, one of which is S4 times ADS7, and the other of which is, of course, S7 times ADS4. So these are the analogs of the spaces that of this product space that I mentioned for the n equals 2. So these have the product metric, and there's a natural ansatz for the four form. There's a natural ansatz for the four form in these models, and so these have maximal synthesis. Now, we also have flat space. And an interesting question is whether you can have solutions which... one takes one's motivation a bit from soliton theory and monopoles, for example, where the symmetry... Take the ordinary monopoles of Yang-Mills theory. You have a broken symmetric phase in that case at infinity where the Higgs mechanism operates, but in the core of the monopole the Higgs field vanishes, which is like the unbroken phase, and this is characteristic of many solitonic systems where you have a kind of spatial interpolation between two different ground states or vacua of the theory. It's seen most clearly in a domain wall where you've got two vacua and you interpolate in space. You have a solution which let's say phi is the field, then suppose that phi equals 1 and phi equals minus 1 were ground states of the theory, then you can have a domain wall where the field phi in X interpolates smoothly between two vacua. So the question is, can you have the analog situation with respect to the supergravity vacua? And the answer to that is yes, and you can write down explicit solutions which have half the supersymmetry, so they're BPS solutions with half the supersymmetry, which do indeed interpolate between these two objects. And they have the character of brains, and I'm just going to explain that briefly in the last few moments. So there is an M2 brain solution. The metric depends transverse dimensions, depends on a harmonic function, the full form F is d of dt wedge, actually I'm going to call that x1 and x2, now this solution has f with in some sense electric components, because when you stand up this, you're going to get a dt factor. And it also has invariance under the Poincaré group in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And these are like transverse coordinates to what is, should be thought of as a sort of membrane. So here you think of the coordinate t, x1, x2 and x3, and then there are some transverse coordinates. And h is just a harmonic function, which in the simplest case is just 1 plus the relevant pole, which is 1 over r plus 6, I hope, if I've got the numbers right. So h is harmonic on this eight-dimensional space. So this is a kind of solitonic version of the M2 braid. Should be envisaged as a superposition of many fundamental M2 brains. You can check out that there is obviously a coordinate singularity at r equals 0, but if you examine the metric carefully, you find that it tends to ADS4 times S7 near r equals 0 in a geometrical way, which may be explained later by Gary Horowitz. So that's the classical image of the two brain constructed as a fundamental theory by Birkhoff, Townsend and Susskind. And there's also the dual five brain, and I'll finish by writing down the formulae for the five brain. So the five brain solution five coordinates here. Again, a harmonic function, but now in the transverse space, it should be five dimensional. So H is harmonic on E5. You've got invariance here. Under Poincaré group, acting isometrically, of course, in 5 plus 1 dimensions. And you have an interpolation, which I'll sketch briefly, what I mean by interpolation, between this and the complementary S4 times ADS7 vacuum near the throat. So a geometric way of seeing what I mean by this is as follows. Concentrate on the spatial sections, factoring out these translations here, and you get, in the simplest case, a rotationally invariant spatial manifold. At infinity it looks like a plane, and then as you go in geometrically it becomes a long thin tube. So it tends from being a flat space out here, has a flat end here, to having a product of R times S, well in this case S4. Okay, so it's like a long thin wormhole. And when you put that R factor, that R piece, together with these coordinates on the world volume, as it were, you find here that they compose into the metric on anti-de Sitter space, so that the space-time picture looks much more like this spatial interpolation. Okay, well, with those remarks, I'm afraid I've gone on rather long. I'll finish. Thank you. What I should have said, which I've said it implicitly, is that you find these by just demanding that there is a coherently constant spinner.
Just one.
Half of the full 32.
So